oi oi, wie geht es gewein in hier in der Heim. Mit der Schiene hat Deutsche der Mame hier in der Heim. In mir bleib hat du weine, Sham yo shamni gam bukhini oy oy oy
gule di loy di si shine ya dolce di va bisti
oy 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 oy
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Tonight's shiur has been sponsored by our very good friend, Bezalel Fleischman. And this is in honor of his mother's yahrzeit, his mother's first yahrzeit, Perel Bas Naftali. So may her neshama have a very big aliyah, and she bring blessings down to him, to his family, to his daughter, and to all of us, all the Jewish people. The CD this week was sponsored by an anonymous donor, and this is in honor of Sima Bas Mordechai. Again, may her neshama have a very high aliyah, and a lot of blessings to him, to his family, and a very big yashar koyach, and thank you to both of them. This week, Parshas Vayechi, the concluding and last parsha of the first Sefer of the Torah, Sefer Bereishis. The custom by the Jewish people is at the conclusion of the book, we announce Chazak, Chazak, V'nitzchazek. Let us strengthen ourselves. Let us become stronger. We draw strength from the conclusion of a book. And that is because the Torah is life. The Torah is spiritual life to our neshama, to our soul. And therefore, every time we study anything in the Torah, that invigorates us, that energizes the neshama. However, when we complete a full section of the Torah, we make a siyum, so then the life that flows, we receive a stronger, more potent transmission of energy into our neshama. And that is even if we make an individual siyum. When we make when a group of people together make a siyum, then it has greater power. How much more so when it's the entire community of the Jewish people? All Jews around the world this week are finishing the Sefer Bereishis. And it's not just a book, but it's the first book of the Torah. So we can imagine how powerful and how strong is the injection, the empowerment, the light that we receive on this Shabbos is enormous, is unbelievable. So we need to understand what is the content of that inspiration, what is the chazak, what do we strengthen ourselves with at the end of Bereishis, even though it's really undefinable, because it's the Torah, it's something so great and beyond our understanding, beyond our comprehension. But since the reason for this chizuk, for this strength, is to empower us in our service of Hashem, to help us fulfill our mission better, So it's good if we have some kind of an understanding of what the message is that we have to strengthen ourselves in, and that what we become stronger in at the end of Bereishis. So to understand this, let's read the end, the last few psukim of what the Torah tells us. It's speaking about Yosef's passing. Yosef died, and what he tells his family, his children, his brothers before he passes. So it says that right before Yosef left this world, he gathered his family and he administered an oath. And he told them that even though he wasn't going to be buried in the land of Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, but he was going to be buried in Mitzrayim, however, when they leave, they shouldn't forget him and they should take him along. And the famous words of Yosef, Pakod Yifkoy Delekim Eschem, that Hashem is going to remember you, and the time of the redemption is going to arrive, I want you to carry me out of Mitzrayim. In the last and final pasuk, it says, Vayomos Yosef, Yosef died, the doctors embalmed him, and then the last words, literally the last words, Vayisem Ba'oroin B'Mitzrayim. They put him into a casket in Mitzrayim. And that's how Sefer Bereishis concludes. Now, just reading this, it's a little bit of a downer. It's a disappointing ending. Here we have a book, an exciting book. There's so much inspiration, there's so much energy, there's so much fire in the book. And over here, we end with the death of Yosef. And that Yosef was put into a coffin in Mitzrayim. That is, what is inspirational? What is exciting about that? Especially since we know that the reason why they buried Yosef in Mitzrayim was because of Yosef, was due to the control of the Egyptians. Yosef, of course, would have wanted to be buried with his father, or buried in there in the land of Israel. Especially then he saw how much it meant to his father Yaakov. But he knew that he didn't have the power for that, because Mitzrayim had control. So this was indicating already the control that the foreign nation or the Egyptian nation was having on the Jewish people. So this was indicative of the beginning of the exile. The great steel doors of the Egyptian imprisonment was clamping shut on them. And we all know the most frightening thing for a person to hear is the sounds of the prison doors as they clamp shut. So when we read about this, and we recognize that now we're going to be going into a life, into a period of time and of pain and suffering and misery, so what is the great inspiration that we're supposed to be inspired by reading this pasuk, reading this pasuk about Vayosem Ba'oren B'Mitzrayim, that Yosef died and they put him in an oren? What's inspirational about that? And we also know that there is a cloud, there is a general principle in the Torah, that Mesaimen B'Dover Tov, that you're supposed to conclude a book with on a positive note, with a good message. The Gemara says, the Talmud tells us, Masechtas in Tractate Brachos, the first of the Gemara, in Daf Lamed Aleph, on page 31, so it says that even the first Nevi'im would conclude their prophecies, their books of prophecies, with positive, with something good. Even if they sometimes needed to speak harshly and rebuke the Jewish people, but they always saw to it to end with something good, with words of comfort and the like. As it says, that they would conclude b'divrei shvach, they would conclude with words of praise and comfort. The Tosfos, the great commentary on the Talmud, in the last Tosfos, in the entire Talmud, in the end of Masechtas Nida, says the reason why the Talmud over there concludes with something that doesn't seem related to the earlier subject that it is discussing. Tana Devei Eliyahu, they learned in the Academy of Eliyahu that whoever studies halacha every day is going to be a man of the world to come. That doesn't seem to belong there. So Tosfos says the Gemara concludes with that because Mesaimen B'Dover Tov, because you want to conclude with a good thing, with something positive. So if this is true about every book, how much more so when we're talking about the five books of the Torah itself, and particularly the first book, the first book, first and foremost, Sefer in the Torah. So Why is it that over here we're deviating from this rule and we end with something that seems to be negative, with a painful and sad thing? Especially since we find that in the next book, in Sefer Shemois, the Pasuk repeats this. The verse tells us again about Yosef's passing. As it says, these are the names of the Jewish people. And then it says that Vayomos Yosef, that Yosef died, the Echav and his brothers, the Chol Adorahu, and that entire generation. And we understand why it needs to repeat it over there in the book in the beginning of Sefer Shemois, is because this was an essential part in the opening up, or the enabling of the Golos, of the exile, to kick in. It was required that Yosef and his brothers should die. Because as long as that generation was alive, there couldn't have been an exile. So the verse tells us that Yosef died. So the question is, once the Torah is repeating this information anyways, it's telling it to you in Parshas Shemos that Yosef died, so then it didn't have to say it in the end of Bereishis. It could have concluded Sefer Bereishis a few psukim earlier, where it speaks about, where it tells us very nice things about the life of Yosef and the tranquility of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, in the land of Mitzrayim, and they lived in Goshen. And in the last verses could have been, it speaks about how Yosef lived to see his children and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren who were born, as it says, with the Arbuke Yosef on the lap of Yosef, which is so beautiful. So we could have ended with that. And then we would have been Messiah and B'dover Toiv, we would have ended with something positive. And after that, we could have began the book of Shemos, speak about the passing of Yosef. And it would have added over there already some more detail of what the doctors did and how they buried him. And which, as we said, that's already part of the beginning of the story of the exile, which belongs in Sefer Shemos. Once we're talking already about where we ought to separate the two books of the Torah, where one is to end and the other one is to begin, then if we look a little, we examine it carefully, we might say that the ending of Sefer Bereishis, if anything, should not have been with the passing of Yosef. It should have been two chapters farther, after it discusses the Egyptian exile. Because we know that the difference between the book of Bereishis and the book of Shemos is that the book of Bereishis is the book of the fathers, and the book of Shemos is the book of the children. It's the story of the Jewish people. Now, when did the Jewish people become a nation? Where did we receive form into a nation, an identifiable nation? Wasn't when we were populated and we became many, but as we see in Sefer Yechezkel, we emerge as a nation when the Jewish people left Egypt. At the time of the redemption, at the time of the Exodus, by Yetzias Mitzrayim, that's when we were born as a people. Up to that point, we have a story up to then. It's all the preliminary elements which are leading up to the development of this nation. The lives of the fathers and the tribes, and even the Jewish people suffering in Mitzrayim, this was all, perhaps we can say, the decaying of the seed, at least this last part, the exile, so that it can the plant can grow. So if that's the case, so the Golus part really belongs still in Sefer Bereishis, and the exile, the suffering. And the story of the Jewish people should begin where Hashem speaks to Moshe and he tells him to go take the Jews out of Egypt, where the miracles begin and so forth. As Nachmanides characterizes and calls Sefer Shemos, Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption. And the redemption, so it should have been beginning with the redemption. We went out of Egypt, we marched to Sinai, to Har Sinai, to receive the Torah. That's where it should have began. Why conclude at this point where the Torah ends now? Whereas they say in Yiddish, it's nishtahin and nishtaher. It's not here, it's not there, it's right in the middle. Because it's discussing the Egyptian exile, but it's ending right in the middle of it. We have already Yaakov and his children descending to Egypt, and the Jewish people relocating from the land of Israel into Egypt, and the passing of Yaakov, and the passing of Yosef, and the brothers, and then it stops,
right there, and then it continues with the exile, with the development of the exile in the beginning of Shemais. So again, everything in the Torah is so precise, so we need understanding for this. The other interesting thing is, we know that there is a rule in the Torah that the beginning and the end are related. The beginning of every book and the end of every book have similar character, similar, there is something common at the beginning and at the end. And that is, we see that on Simchas Torah, for instance. We conclude the Torah, we make a siyum on Simchas Torah, but we don't stop. We instantly start over again. And from the beginning of Bereishis. And as we say, when we call up the Chassan Bereishis, I think it's the Chassan Bereishis, the one who's going to have the opening blessing on the Torah, the one that's going to begin the book of Bereishis, we say, Maskifin Haschola LaHashlama. We connect, we put close the beginning of the Torah to the end of it. And that's why we have so much commentary has been written on the connection and the similarity between the opening verse of the Torah of Bereishis and the last verse of the Torah of La'ene Kol Yisrael. What do they have in common? And this is based on a teaching, in one of the teachings, the teaching of Sefer Yetzirah, which is a book attributed to Avram Avinu. So in Sefer Yetzirah, it says that not tchiloson b'soifon, v'soifon b'tchiloson, that the beginning is wedged in the end, and the end is wedged in the beginning, meaning that there is a connection in all realms of holiness. There is always a connection of the beginning point and the end point, because really holiness is connected to God, and God is endless. And the same is with the Torah. The Torah is endless and infinite. So there is no beginning and an end. And even when the Torah is given to us in a finite form, we have the beginning of the book and the end of the book, it's only that's the way it appears to us. But in essence, it goes on forever. For that reason, we read the Torah like a circle. We over and over again, and like this, which is expressing that it never ends. And that's why the end point and the end and the beginning are related and have a similar message. So we need to understand over here, that would be true also about the beginning and the end of the book of Bereishis. What is the similar message between the beginning of Bereishis and the end of Bereishis? And more specifically, the connection and the similarity between the beginning and the end of a book can't be in some fringe element, in some detail. We will find something similar, something alike, that is in the beginning and the end. It has to be in regards to the root point, the main and essential message, the root idea of what the book represents. And that is emphasized in the beginning, and that point is emphasized in the end. The beginning, it's emphasized because the beginning is the head, just like the head in the human being. The head controls the entire body, but it also encapsulates everything, the entire energy and everything that will happen in the body is really there in the head. So that's why the first pasuk of the Torah is considered the head of the Torah. It has the main theme of what the Torah is all about, or what this book in the Torah, which in our case would be Bereishis. There's also a statement we know, Hakol Hoylech Achar Achitum. Everything goes after the conclusion. The signature, the last verse, the signature. It summarizes everything. So the beginning and the end are similar because they both express the main primary theme of what this book is all about. So we need to understand what does the beginning of Bereishis and the end of Bereishis have in common. The beginning, we're learning about Bereishis, Bara Lekimes HaShemayim V'Sa'aretz. We're learning about that beautiful moment when God created the world. The world is new. Hashem is enjoying the creation that He created. It's a such a positive and good feeling to read that verse. And then we get to the end of Sefer Bereishis, that Yosef died and they put him in a coffin in Mitzrayim. What's the connection? What's the similarity? How do these things possibly relate, and that they both express the theme of what Bereishis is all about? So to understand this, we need to delve a little bit deeper into the beginning and see what does it really say in the beginning. So when we open up the book of Bereishis, right at the beginning, and we begin the first pasuk, we read Bereishis bara Elokim. In the beginning, God created. As a shamayim, the heavens or the earth, or as Rashi says, we're supposed to read it in the beginning when God created heaven and earth. Now, instantly, on those first two words, Bereishis bara, or even just maybe just on Bereishis, Rashi makes a comment. Rashi says like this: Bereishis bara at the beginning when God created. Omer Rabbi Yitzchak says, the Torah should not have started from this story, from Bereishis bara Elokim. The Torah should have began from the later on, from the pasuk Chodesh Hazalachem. Now it's interesting, it's so typical. So it's a typical Jewish thing. We haven't even started. The Torah didn't even finish the sentence. It just said Bereishis bara and there's already an objection. Why like this? Why did you now say that? Why are you telling this? It should have started with something else. And that is because nothing slips by the scrutinizing eyes of our sages. So there is, Rashi is uncomfortable. There's something wrong with the way the Torah starts, which seems to be wrong with the way the Torah starts. It's telling us a story about God creating heaven and earth. And Rashi says that story, of course, it's very, very important information that Hashem created the heavens. But that does not belong in the Torah. Why? The Torah is a book which was given to the Jewish people to instruct us on how to live our lives in accordance to Hashem's will. The main point of the book of the Torah, 613 commandments, which enable us to bond and to connect with Hashem. That's the guide to Jewish life. That's, as the Zohar says, the word Torah is from the word Lashon Hara. It's a direction. It's supposed to teach us and guide us. If that's the case, the story of creation doesn't belong here, because it's not a mitzvah. We should have began with the first mitzvah. The first mitzvah where Hashem is addressing the Jewish people as a whole, not the private mitzvahs that were given earlier, but the mitzvah where Hashem is addressing the Jewish people, which is what the book is all about, that should have been the opening verse of the pasuk. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, the mitzvah of setting the calendar, which is in the third portion, in the second book of the Torah, in Sefer Shemais. Why then the Matam Pasach Bereishis? Why do you start with Bereishis? Why do we start with Bereishis? Again, it's a very, very important to know the origins of creation. It's very important to know the wonderful lives of the patriarchs and our matriarchs, and to know their nobility, and know of their kindness, and know of their dedication and devotion to Hashem. But this is not this book. If Hashem wanted to tell that to us, He could have given it to us in another book. It could have been called the Chronicles of the Jewish People, Toldos Am Yisrael, or it could have been called Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Yetzirah, the Book of the Creation, is the other book of Avraham Avin. And then the Torah will begin with instructions to the Jewish people, and he explains. So why did the Torah begin with Bereishis? Because, as he brings a verse from Psalms, from Tehillim, I think it's in Psalm 111 or 112, where it says like this: Koyach Maisav Higid Liyamoy, Loseis Lahem Nachlas Goyim. The power of his actions, the power of his deeds, which is the book of Bereishis, the power of God's deeds, because the world, which is created through his power, Higid Liyamoy, he related that to his people, meaning he gave us the book of Bereishis. And what's the reason for that? Loseis Lahem Nachlas Goyim. To give to them the inheritance of the nations. The reason why Hashem tells us the book of Bereishis, and this is part of the Torah, is in order to give us the inheritance of the nations. What does that mean, to give us the inheritance of the nations? She'im yoimru umayso elam. If the nations in the world are going to come, and they're going to say, listem atem, you are thieves, you are robbers, you are bandits, you have stolen our land. The land of Israel wasn't yours. There were ancient civilizations that lived there, the Canaan and the other old nations that lived and inhabited the land of Canaan. and you came and you attacked and you stole their land from them. So you are thieves. So what are the Jewish people going to answer? It says in the Pasuk over here, we see in the Torah that God created heaven and earth. And being that God is the creator of heaven and earth, that means He is the boss. He owns heaven and He owns earth. He owns the entire globe. And for that, and therefore He can decide who lives where. But it was with God's will, Nasna Lahem, He gave it to them. He was the one who gave it to the initially to the seven nations, allowing them to live in the land. And it was at His will when He took it from them and Nasnalana when He gave it to us. Which means that God's ownership over something is so thorough and so complete that even when He gives it away, He doesn't relinquish His ownership. It's still His. It's not like when a human being owns something. Because when we own something, our owning of the thing is only to a certain degree. Because we're not responsible for the very beingness of that object, of that entity. So even if we, and therefore our ownership is more of an external kind of an ownership. So if we sell the object or we give it as a gift, it's not ours anymore. But Hashem, the reason for Him owning the world is because He created it. And creating it means that he brings it from absolute nothingness into existence. So His ownership is to the fullest. He owns it thoroughly, completely. So when He gives the land to someone, He doesn't disown it. When He gives it, it's sort of like a rental or like a lease. He allows them to live, like we find even when the Jewish people, in regards to our ownership in the land of Israel, in the land of Eretz Yisrael, we express this in the keeping of the laws of Shemitah, of the sabbatical years. It's a demonstration how we recognize that the Hashem owns the land. Kli kol ha'aretz. The land belongs to Him, not to us. And we are just His guest in the land. So our answer to the nations of the world is that true, God was the one who let you live in that land, but then at a certain point in history, He decided to take it away from you and give it to the Jewish people. Good. So now we understand why the Torah begins with Bereishis. However, every thinking person has to have a question. I mean, this Rashi, which is seems to be very problematic, because we're talking about the Torah. We're talking about the holiest of holies, the book of all books, the root of all wisdom and of all knowledge. We understand that everything in this book is so accurate and so precise. And this book constitutes the divine wisdom and the divine will. Hashem puts His everything into the Torah. And that's why He cherishes it. It's something so dear and so meaningful. It expresses His most intimate desires, His most and all of His wisdom. And He gave it to who? And He gave it and this is the concept of the mitzvahs. The mitzvahs are the deepest desires, most personal wants of Hashem that He wants to share with His people. And we say that this incredible Torah, that is the most precious thing in all of existence, was supposed to begin with a Chodesh Hazeh Lachem. That's what it's about, therefore that's where it starts. However, Hashem went and He altered and He changed the Torah. Why? Because there might be some complainers. There will be people, there might come a time when the nations in the world will have a complaint. And they will say, Listamat, and you are thieves. And for that reason, God goes and He changes the Torah. He amends and patches the Torah, fixes it and changes it. He adds a piece that doesn't belong there in order to refute the argument of the nations. You change the Torah to accommodate complainers? Little earthlings, tiny human beings living down here are going to make a change in the wisdom of Hashem? In the infinite wisdom of God? That doesn't make any sense. And even if we say, well, it is important, Hashem wants to make it easy for us, that we should have an answer to the complaints of the nations. Good. So if we need a document in order to show the people that God was the one who created the world, so Hashem could have, we said earlier, could have given us another document. Another, it would have been authentic, This is a document that Hashem has given it to us, as we said, a story telling us about creation, and we would have used that as the proof. Why does it have to be in the Torah? You know, when the Congress or the Senate has to pass a bill, so we understand that they need to make amendments and they need to make changes that in order to accommodate all political parties, in order to accommodate the people. So they have to make alterations and concessions. So even if initially the bill was supposed to mean it was supposed to come out one way, at the very end, it is all patched up. Why? Because you have to pass it. You're thinking about the PR, you're thinking about public opinion, you're thinking about re-election. So all this affects the way you write the bill. But that is by human beings. This is Hashem. And he's changing his Torah. Making it for what? To look nice. It doesn't sound right. And as we said, it could have been given to us in another document. And even for whatever reason is, to disprove the nation, even if we're going to say it's only the Torah that would work. Because only the Torah would command the respect. And any other book wouldn't, which we don't know why, but for whatever, even if we say that, why does it have to be right at the beginning of the Torah? Why does he have to begin with Bereishis? The beginning, the most vital part, the opening of the book? Put it somewhere, slip it in the middle. Put it in the end as an appendix. At the beginning? Why? What sense does it make to change and speak about something that is unrelated to the Torah? For what? For a complaint in the nations. So therefore, this leads us to the conclusion that this is not an alteration of the Torah. And this is not to accommodate the nations of the world and their complaints. But this is essential to the Torah, to what the Torah is all about. And it's essential to the Jewish people. Since the Torah is an instruction to the Jewish people on how they are supposed to live, both the Torah and the Jewish people, their ultimate fulfillment and mission, which they need to accomplish, is the accomplishment of, includes the conquering of the land of the nations, taking possession of the land of Israel, which is the conquering of the land of the nations, and dealing with the aftermath of the objections and the complaints and the accusing fingers of the nations of saying that we stole, and what the response needs to be. That is essential to the Torah. That is essential to the Jewish mission of the Jewish people. So we're not changing anything from what it was supposed to be. This needs to be there because this is an integral part of Yiddishkeit, of Torah and Mitzvahs. Not only is it an important part, but it is one of the most crucial elements of the Torah. And it's for that reason that it's right at the beginning. Pasach beBereishis. The Torah begins with Bereishis. Because of Koyach Mais of Higid Liyamui. Because Hashem tells us the power of his actions so that we can deal with the world and answer the questions of why we have taken their land. But to understand this a little better, why is this so essential to Judaism and to our mission and to the overall purpose of the Torah? So in order to understand that, we have to dig a little deeper into the question or the accusation of the nations. We are being accused that we have stolen the land. Now the question, simple question is, why us? Are we the only ones who have taken away someone's land? And what is with every nation in the world? How did all civilizations begin? Where did all nations get their lands? It was through conquest. First there were primitive people living in various different places, and then people banded together, formed a group, and they occupied that land, and they chased away whoever they didn't like, and they set up their flag, and this is a nation. And when their appetite grew, they attacked their neighbor's property and annexed it to theirs. This is how it happened in all countries and in all places, in ancient history and even in recent history. The Greeks and Alexander the Great went and conquered the city, country after country, the Romans. And then The Europeans came to America and chased the Native Americans away and took over the land. And no one is complaining. Everybody understands that's the way the world runs. So why are we an exception? Why are the Jewish people being accused for stealing the land? And this is, you see from Rashi, this is Rashi's prophesizing. This is going to be this way till the very end, even today. And not just even today, but very strongly today. We, the Jewish people, are accused for stealing the land, whether it's stealing from the Palestinians or whatever. Why are you, living in occupied territories? You have taken the land that doesn't belong to you. Besides for the lies that entail in it, but the whole accusation in the first place is baseless. Because then the Americans should vacate this land and give it back to the Native Americans. The other interesting thing is that Rashi tells us, She'im yomru ummay sa'olam, the nations in the world are going to say, meaning not just the descendants of the seven nations who lived in the land of Canaan, the entire world is going to be in an uproar. Everybody's going to complain. So we do see, let's say, in America, there are people that have grievances and complaints and arguments. Those are the descendants of the Native Americans, who some of them don't want to assimilate into American life, and they want to claim that this land is still theirs, and that's why they demand of America, of the United States, to give them portions. And they have portions of land, which is not governed by American law. Which is their land. But it's them that are complaining. Who else is complaining? Maybe a few activists, noisy activists, who look for something, a cause to fight for. But generally in the world, people are not complaining. There's no Norwegians or Swedish people or people in Zimbabwe or in Argentina and Venezuela that care and they're demanding that America has occupied land that isn't theirs. No one gives a hoot for that. When it comes to the Jewish people, it's all across the world. It's all across cultures, across and people from all races and all ethnicities are in complaint and demanding that the Jewish people relinquish their hold of the land of Israel. Why? What is the universal outcry? Now, we can blame it on ordinary anti-Semitism. Say it's an age-old anti-Semitism. But that, too, needs an explanation. Why does the anti-Semitism express itself in this aspect of we cannot have a piece of land? It's a tiny little strip of land. Can hardly be seen on the map. But no, they can't have this. And the answer, possible answer to this, the reason the nations are complaining is because they know something about the Jewish people. They know something about us, and they know us very well, in certain ways, better than we know ourselves. And what they know about the Jewish people is that the Jewish people is a holy nation. We are a godly people. And whether they know this consciously or whether this is embedded in their subconscious, but they recognize that the Jewish people is the Am HaNivchar, this is the chosen nation, that this is the people that God himself came down to Egypt and plucked them from slavery, took them to the mount, to the bottom of the mountain and made a covenant with them and gave them his Torah. And it's precisely because of that they have complaints. Because they say, okay, we respect that. We respect that you're a holy people. God is entitled to choose whoever he likes for a wife. That's his decision. That's okay. We have no problem with that. Our problem is that when you go ahead and settle a land like all other nations, that we cannot agree with. Why? Because you're holy and you're a godly people, then you're different than the rest of the world. And what constitutes your nationality is your obedience to God and your serving of Hashem. So you are, as the Torah says, Mamleches Kohanim, a kingdom of priests. So as priests, you belong in segregation, you belong in monasteries. You should all go together into a monastery and worship your God. If you're so holy and you're such heavenly people, so why don't you go up on top of the Himalaya mountains and wear robes and sandals and engage in your worship, do your mitzvahs, and have your meditations and your spiritual experiences. What does that have to do with earth? Earth is our world. This is our territory. This is our place. Earth is not the environment for that kind of life that you want to live. It doesn't belong on Earth. That's not what Earth is all about. Earth is a place which is mundane. Earth is mundane. Earth is godless territory. Earth is a place where there is no feeling of responsibility towards a higher authority, where there is no sense of servitude. Earth is a place where the ego dominates, where the ego rules, a place where you can live your life without a conscience, a place where you can live guilt-free. You do as you wish, as you want. And it's the only place where you can live like that. Because in they understand there is a sense of heaven, and that is not only to the Jewish people, a feeling and a sense that there are higher realities, there are angels and above and so forth. The general awareness of world population believes in. So, and they recognize and understand, heaven is a place where you sense God. That's God's territory. Over there, everybody is obedient to Hashem. Angels in heaven live in a constant state of surrender. Every moment they're thinking about, am I serving you, Hashem? What do you want me to do, God? It's a perpetual state of Hineni. I'm here to serve you. Not so in this world. This world is a place of concealment where Hashem has hidden, and where there is no one. You're living in the world. Earth, we mean the general world, the general physical condition is a condition which lends itself to be oblivious to God. And if there is no God, then I take the place of God. And I do what I want. I wish, I live my life in pursuit of my own pleasures and my own gratification. Life is one long chain of self-perpetuation, of self-gratification. That's life on earth. And therefore, Jews don't fit into this world. Now, okay, you are a physical being, so you live in this world. That's okay. Find yourself some corner. Go up go as close to heaven as you can and make yourself a colony. That's where you can live. However, when you settle in the land and you go and you occupy territory or take land and you claim this is your land and you want to live like a nation similar to all other nations in this material physical world, that is something we can't agree with. That is something that pricks us. That is something that goes against the grain of what we are all about. That disproves our entire life and our entire existence. Because if you are living a physical life in this world, you are making a proclamation. You are making a statement that life on earth could be a godly life, and it should be a higher life geared towards a godly purpose. Because you are living like everybody else. You're engaging in business and in commerce. You have farming, and you eat and you drink and you go shopping and you drive cars and you have buses and taxis and airplanes and an army and everything that is that the rest of the world does, and you use computers and modern technology. But you're doing all of that with a higher purpose. You have your mitzvahs, where you're serving God in all the details of material life, which is demonstrating that earth too is a creation created by God, meant to serve God. That not only is the soul God's possession, but the body is also God's possession. Not only does heaven, is heaven part of the godly kingdom, but earth too is included in God's sovereignty. And it too is meant to serve Him, nothing other than Him. That demonstration, that message is very, very disturbing to the universal consciousness. That is something that people cannot live with. That makes everybody uncomfortable. Because my life without the Jewish people, then I can live it up. I can drive my Lamborghini. I can enjoy barbecue ribs and martinis. and all kinds of other fun and enjoyable times. I don't have to think about the tomorrow. I don't have to think about accountability. And I just have a good time. Life is wonderful. But when the Jew is living in the land of Israel, when the Jew occupies, takes land, and claims that earth is godly, that makes that a Gentile in Germany cannot enjoy his ripsteak. That ruins the romantic life of a person in Paris. And that's why this unnerves the entire world. That's why there's such a objection, a overall objection to Jews having a homeland. Because possession of earth for a holy nation is something that people don't want to hear about. And the answer, of course, is that we are not thieves. We're not taking something that doesn't belong to us. Because God is the creator of heaven and earth. As Rashi says, Koyach maisov higid liyamoy, the power of his deeds he told his people. Bereishis bara lekim et ha-shamayim ve'esa oretz, that in the beginning when God created heaven and earth, God is the master of earth just as he is the master of heaven. And even this, that the earth feels, and this the feeling that earth gives off, is that this is an independent, autonomous existence, where we can live in an unrelated, where this is what people call my private life, don't butt into my life. Even that feeling is something that God allowed. Not only allowed, he wanted. He wanted that the Jewish people should live in a world where the natural feeling and the natural underlying, or the feeling and sense prior to our worship, prior to our changing of it, is that this is an autonomous place. This is unrelated to Hashem. And here we do as the ego wants, as is the wish of our bodies and our physical desires. And that very unholy world, we should take and change it. We should take that land and turn it into a land of the Jewish people. That's what Rashi means. Hashem created the world, it was with his desire and his want that he gave it to them. Which means, as we read in the story of Bereishis, God allowed for this world to drift away and separate itself from him. As we see the story of Bereishis, he goes and creates the world. Instantly, what is the first story? How Adam doesn't listen to him. Adam and Eve. And they sin, and they're chased out of the Garden of Eden, and they cause a disconnect of the entire creation from God, and the world begins to spiral down, to plunge down, and for 2,000 years there's darkness and chaos and rebellion against God and disobedience. And that means Bitzoyna, he was the one who gave it to them. Why? Because that was his desire, that a unholy, dark, disconnected world we should reoccupy and reign the world in, draw it back into a relationship with God. And that is why the Torah continues that after all that darkness, the first Jew emerges. Avram Avinu comes onto the scene and he proclaims that God is the God of heaven and the God of earth, and that all mankind has to serve Hashem. And he plants the seed of monotheism and changes the tide of humanity forever and ever. He draws, his influence begins to extend and to grow, and he establishes a family that is going to reclaim earth and establish the divine kingdom in the world. As Vahoya Hashem Lamelech al Kol Ha'aretz, that God is going to be the king over the entire land, over heaven and earth. And that is what Judaism is all about, to make that proclamation. We make that proclamation and we make that statement when we live as a Jew all over the world. When the non-Jew sees the Jew living a normal, material, physical life. He has a home like everybody else, and he has a car like everybody else. He has a kitchen like everybody else, and a bedroom like everybody else. But over here, there's different rules in the Jewish home. In the Jewish home, God is the one that rules. It's not my kitchen, it's God's kitchen. He determines what I eat, when I will eat, how I cook my food, and when I have to take the food that I make and throw it in the garbage because it's not kosher. Because by mistake, a little tiny bit of milk fell into the meat. And God is the one who decides my wardrobe, what I can wear and what I can't wear. There's a mixture of wool and linen, and therefore I can't wear this, even if I like that suit very, very much, and I love that outfit. God is the one who decides what I can do in the privacy of my own bedroom. In the most intimate, personal elements, where the general, where the Gentile says, don't butt in, this is my me, this is my life. The Jew says, no, there is no space devoid from Hashem. Hashem comes into everything. That's conquering the land of the nations. First, by taking a piece, one strip of land, and saying that this land, earth, this piece of land belongs to Hashem, and then expanding. Because it's not just about the land of Israel. Ultimately, it's the entire world. Because the entire world has to become Eretz Yisrael. As it says, when Mashiach will come, Asida Eretz Yisrael shetespashet b'chol ha'aratzos. That the land of Israel is going to expand into all the nations. What does it mean? It means that the holiness and the godly submission and surrender to Hashem, which is the land of Israel, which is in the land of Israel, when Jews are living in the land of Israel in accordance to the will of Hashem, in accordance to the with the governed by the laws of the Torah, is something that is going to expand into the entire world, where the entire world is going to live in surrender and in submission to Hashem. Now, we as Jews are not stealers. We're not trying to make anybody uncomfortable. We're not trying to ruin it for anybody, ruin everybody's fun. Quite on the opposite. The worst thing, the most painful situation, is for a person to be enslaved to their own ego. When you're enslaved to your ego, you're a prisoner, you're stuck, you're not happy. You become neurotic. It is unhealthy. It is a lie. What we are stealing, if we are stealing anything, is we're stealing the lie. The Jew is melting, of causing the lie to evaporate. The lie that there is possibility to have a godless existence, that is being taken away from the world. When we live with a purpose, we live serving Hashem, we live in true happiness and in true joy. When Mashiach will come, there will be a universal song. The world will sing forever and ever, because the world will be liberated from the shackles of ego. There will be happiness, but that is after the ego has been eliminated. Until that point, as long as the ego still dominates, the ego feels very threatened by the Jewish people. Very, very uncomfortable with the Jew. And that is why there is the proclamation, you're stealing our territory, you're digging into me, you're not letting me live my carefree life because you are taking possession of the land. Now we'll understand the ending of Sefer Bereishis and how it leads into Sefer Shemos, and why the ending of Sefer Bereishis has to conclude exactly at the point where it concluded, with the passing of Yosef and Yosef being put in Mitzrayim. Because this whole process has two phases to it. There is the book of Bereishis, which is phase number one, and that is that it's in the book of Bereishis, as Rashi clarifies at the beginning, as we said earlier, the content of the entire book of Bereishis is to demonstrate that this world is God's world. Koyach Maisav Higid Liyamoy, that Hashem tells us the power of his actions. Los Islam Nachlas Goyim. And as mentioned before, in the book of Bereishis, we see already the whole evolving events of the world going through three stages. First, God creating it, and of course, as he creates it, he's the owner of the entire world. Then him, so to speak, letting go, allowing the world to assume an identity of its own, and then him repossessing the world through the others. And that is why, what do we find in the book of Bereishis? Okay, we find how Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov served Hashem, but we see something quite astonishing. In every conversation that God has with Avram, or with our forefathers, what is the subject? Almost every conversation. Every time, he's always talking about the land. I promise you, your children are going to have the land. You're going to take possession of it. Get up and walk across the land, take possession of the land. Again and again. Now God made the promise. Okay, we believe him. He promised once. Why do we need to hear this again and again and again and again? Tells him a little bit about the Jewish people are going to be a great nation. But even more than being a great nation, doesn't stop talking about the land. Now, why is the land possession so important? And the answer is because this is the whole point of the Torah and mitzvahs, is to come down into this world and make this world into a godly place, and that is by taking possession of earth, taking possession of the land. This is the crucial element of Yiddishkeit, and this is what Hashem emphasizes more than anything else. And it is, and Hashem knows what kind of resistance, what kind of fight. The world is going to put up a fight till the very end against Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. So Hashem tells Avram Avinu, your land I will give it to you. So even though the actual possession of the land only came about years later, it was done by the children, it was done by the nation of Israel, with Joshua, with Yeshua, when they came across the Jordan and they took hold of the land. But it was already, this is all based on the Avos, it's all based on the promise that Hashem gave to our fathers. And He told them, you will have the land. So the initial taking possession of the land, of a piece of this world, which is the first phase as mentioned before, that is accomplished in the life of the fathers. Both on a collective level, which means the possession of the land of Israel in a very physical sense, but also in the spiritual sense or psychological sense. This is also very personal. Meaning, taking possession of the land on a personal level means that, what do we say, the difference between a Jewish homeland and a non-Jewish homeland is a Jewish homeland is where God is the ruler, where it's under Hashem's sovereignty. So in our personal lives, it means that when the soul and the body come together, the spirit dominates over matter. The soul dominates over the body. The soul is in control. And the soul uses the body as an instrument to serving Hashem. That the body too must know that it is the possession of God here to serve Him. Now that's the struggle, of course, of life. Because the body and the animal soul of man resists that. The body and the soul, and the body claims that no, I'm here for my own pleasures. I'm here for my own desires. And that's why it has all of its cravings and all of its passions and desires and appetites and lusts and wants. But the soul has to master it. And when the soul can master the body and employ the body to serve Hashem, then you've conquered the land of the nations and made it into Eretz Yisrael. Now to us, this is a raging war all of our lives. Every moment of our lives is the spirit in man is fighting with the earthy consciousness. Earth, the earth and the spiritual are wrestling with each other in a constant battle. So when we wake up in the morning, the body, what kind of day does the body want to have? A day of physical pleasure and enjoyment. A day of pursuing its own desires and wants. However, the soul has to, through prayer, make a statement and say, no! This body and my life is going to be dedicated to serving Hashem with all the details of my life. My hands and my feet are going to do mitzvahs. The money that I'm going to earn today is going to be used to serve what Hashem's interests are. But we fluctuate back and forth. The Avos, the forefathers, were the exemplified and they personified ultimate transcendence of body over, of soul over body. Ultimate conforming of the physical to the spiritual, where the physical was in complete surrender to the spiritual. We find, it says about the nations, it says about the Avos, Ha'avos hein hein ha-markava, that the fathers, they are the vehicle, they are the chariot of God. What is the meaning of them being a chariot? A chariot is a vehicle. A vehicle is in constant surrender to the rider. It's identityless. A car does whatever the driver wants. It moves exactly to the rhythm of the rider. Whichever way you turn this way, it goes that way. Turn the other way, it goes the other way. It never does things on its own. And if it does, it's not a good car. It's not a vehicle. A vehicle is supposed to be available, just or in submission to the rider. When we say that the Avos were the vehicle of God, it means that their entire life, 100%, was dedicated and devoted to Hashem to the point that there wasn't any physical movement. There wasn't any part in their life. Their limbs didn't move. Their fingers didn't move. There wasn't a contraction and expansion of any muscle in their body that was self-serving. Everything was because in some way this is serving Hashem. So they represent the ultimate conquering of the land of Israel, where the physical has no control over them. To us, the physical sometimes sucks us in, draws us in. But by them, complete mastery. So again, as we said, their promise to take possession of the land, which is the ultimate purpose of the Jewish people, finds expression in the life of the Yavis. Through them, they're the empowered. They empower us both physically to take possession of the land of Israel. As we know, as we said earlier, our right to the land is because they did the chazakah, they took possession earlier. And also personally, for each and every one of us to have our neshama in control over our body, our soul over the body, this is given to us by Yerusha as an inheritance from Avram Avinu, from them, and from Yitzhak, and from Yaakov. This is where we get the strength to accomplish this. That's the message in Sefer Bereishis. Sefer Samos, we take it to the next stage. And that is the avod of the children. Because Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov demonstrated how it can be done. But the actual doers of it, the implementers of it into the world in a very thorough, complete way. And to take it outside of just one land and one country, the land of Israel, but to make it universal, to bring this message and to bring the godly kingdom throughout the entire world, will take the next stage, and that is the Jewish people, and particularly not the Jewish people living in the land of Israel, that's the beginning of it, but eventually the Jewish people being dispersed all over the nations, which comes in the time of the exile. When the Jews were exiled from the land of Israel and scattered all over the world, when we live amongst our Gentile neighbors and we live a Jewish life, we are changing their attitude, we are changing the world, we are dismantling the lie, piece by piece. We're undoing it's the underpinnings of this facade of ego throughout the entire world by living within the world and being very much part of the world, but at the same time living with a higher consciousness. It is for that reason that Sefer Shemos begins not with the redemption of the Jewish people and the march to Sinai to receive the Torah, but it begins with the exile, the story of the exile. Why is it starting with the exile? And we said earlier, if it's a Sefer Shel Geula, it should start with the redemption. And that is because, just like Bereishis, in the first overall when we begin to open the book of the Torah tells us right away what it's all about. That Hashem created in heaven and earth, and the purpose of the Torah, as godly and as mystical and as high as the Torah is, nevertheless, it must influence earth. The same is also with the overall purpose of the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, and our taking of the Torah. If the Torah would begin with the story of the redemption of Mitzrayim, I'm sorry, Sefer Shemos would begin with the story of redemption, and it would talk about the giving of the Torah, then it could have given the impression that the purpose of the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people so that we should indulge our spiritual appetites, we should indulge ourselves in the wisdom of the Torah, in the godliness of heaven, but earth is not really part of our mission. However, when we begin, and when we say earth, we mean the outside of the territory of Jewish earth. We would think it's only we need to sublimate our own bodies and our own life, but the rest of the world, the outside world, can remain in the dark. So no, the Torah tells us the story of the Jewish people begins in Golos. It begins when we are enmeshed in the nations. And not just any nation, but the most inhospitable nation, the most resistant nation, the darkest of nations, the lowest of the low, the ones that are the most against holiness. And that land, and that very unholy land, like the land of Egypt that is called Erev HaSa'ar, that's the lowest place in the world, that too must be elevated. That too must be changed. And that was changed by the Jewish people in the exile of Egypt. They were in Mitzrayim. They suffered in Egypt. They were trapped. They were in. The darkness enveloped them. But as it enveloped them, they were eating up. They were eating. They were consuming. They were taking the energy of Mitzrayim, they were taking the life out of Egypt. And then when the time came, when they completed that, they were liberated, and they marched out of Egypt, and they took everything of Mitzrayim with them, whatever was salvageable, whatever was good, the entire wealth, like a Natsluas Mitzrayim, they emptied Egypt out. Because the real manner in which we can have the deepest, lasting, permanent impact on a society and on a world, on any environment, is when we enter into it completely. If we remain on the outside of it, if we remain hovering above it, we can't really change it. The reason why the Jewish people can only change the world by going into galus, into exile, is because that's the way the nation in which we enter in takes us into them, circles us and envelops us. And when we are within them, so to speak, as we might say, we are inside the belly of the beast, that's when we can have the most deep, the deepest and internal influence on that nation. So through the galus of Jews being in Egypt, enslaved as a nation, goy bekerev goy, a nation in the stomach of a nation, it was in that state of mind and that state of existence, which was horrific to us, was really to our benefit, to change and to influence and for the benefit of Egypt, to redeem Egypt from its lowly state. That is why the Sefer Shemois begins with the exile, but it begins exactly at the point where Yosef and the brothers died, and the Jewish people and the rest of the story of the exile, the Jews in exile. Why doesn't it begin, as we said earlier, maybe with why can't we have the descent of Yaakov to Mitzrayim, or that whole, if it's part of the exile, that could have been the beginning of the book of Shemos. But the answer is, the Avos, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, the Shvatim, the tribe, the early generations, they had such intense holiness, their godly awareness was so powerful and so strong, their souls were on such a high level, that the darkness in the world can never possess them, can never take hold of them. That's why they remained above, we said earlier, as soon as Avram, his neshama, Yitzchak, Yaakov came into this world, it mastered the physical instantly. So that's wonderful and that's good. That's very powerful and it's very good for a statement to demonstrate how God is in control and how earth can be dominated by spirit. That's fine. But there is a downside to that, and that is that you can't change the darkness itself if you remain above it. You can't have an internal change. That's why Hashem has to diminish the light of the souls. The next generation had, so to speak, lower souls. Souls that could be sucked into the darkness. Souls that can be entrapped. That can enter into the stomach of the unholy and make the change, an internal, deep, and permanent change, can only come from the people that could become darkened by and influenced, as we find that the children, the Jewish people, when they went into Egypt, were taken into Mitzrayim, affected by Egypt, both spiritually and physically, to the point they were so subjugated to Egypt that they were so taken into the darkness, they were cemented into the walls. Being cemented into walls means they became stuck. Their souls were completely trapped in the walls. They couldn't move. To that degree was this entrapment. To that degree was the chokehold of Mitzrayim. But that is necessary in order to change it. The galus can only begin, the real galus, when the early generation dies and the generation of the children. However, in order to connect these two phases, phase number one is to make the general demonstration that God rules the earth, which was demonstrated in the others, and then to take it to the state of application, where we're going to bring this truth to every nook and cranny of the world, which involves the galus and involves the children and so forth. You need some kind of link that links phase one with phase two. Because the others who are hovering above the galus, above the darkness, and the children who enter into the exile seem to be disconnected. So that's why we needed some kind of a connection between the early generation and the next generation. That's why the end of Sefer Bereishis, the last story in Sefer Bereishis, is how Yaakov and his sons went down to Egypt. Yaakov went down to Egypt, him and his children. Why? Because at least he had to serve as the connector between the transcendental generation and the generation that is going to be struggling with the darkness from within. So Yaakov goes down to Egypt. However, being that he's Yaakov, even when he comes down to Egypt, he's from the fathers, so even when he comes up to Egypt, he right away, it doesn't affect him. What do we learn this week in the parasha? Vayechi Yaakov. Yaakov lived. 17 of his best years were in the land of Egypt. It became an oasis of holiness. Egypt didn't have any effect and impact. They lived in the land of Goshen. It was a Jewish land that had yeshivas. It says Yehuda set up a yeshiva in Egypt. They overpowered the darkness instantly. And he mastered, and Yaakov became the ruler over Egypt. How do we find that? Last week in the parsha it says that Yaakov came before Paro and he blessed him. What was the blessing? That the Nile should rise towards Paro. When Paro came walking to the Nile overflowed, went over its banks, and irrigated the fields. Now we know that Egypt survived on the Nile. The Nile was the entire parnassa and livelihood of Egypt. This was the economy of Egypt. Who controlled the economy of Egypt? Yaakov's blessing. It was clear how Yaakov is in control over Mitzrayim. To a stronger degree, Yosef. Yosef took possession over the entire land. In some way, Yosef is one level lower than Yaakov in the sense that to Yaakov, there was no exile at all. Yosef was taken in temporarily. He was taken down as a slave in Egypt. Egypt was enslaved him. And they ended up in the darkest dungeon of Egypt. But being that he was Yosef, belonging still to the first era of the Jewish people, instantly, quickly, he broke free of the shackles of this imprisonment, and he went up and he became the ruler over the entire Mitzrayim. Because that's what the Jew is. He's the ruler, not his own personal ruler. He is an agent of God's kingship to the world. So Yosef becomes the ruler over Mitzrayim, and he dominates over the entire country. What does that all serve? All this is the empowerment for the next stage to happen. That when Egypt is really going to get a hold and take and grip the Jewish people in its darkness, the Jewish people should remain with their ability, shouldn't get crushed, shouldn't get broken and destroyed by that exile, but should fulfill our mission of emptying and draining the life force out of Egypt and then elevating and coming out, being released, and taking that energy to the land of Israel. And I mentioned 2 weeks ago, in Egypt we did it by stealing the, so to speak, taking the energy and leaving. But in the future Golias, in the future exiles, we don't destroy the nation, we elevate the nation, because we have the Torah, and that's how we elevate it, but that's another subject. But the idea is, in order for the Jews not to be crushed by this darkness, and by this very powerful concealment of Egypt, it was accomplished by Yaakov and Yosef being with them in Egypt, setting the stage of transcendence. And then the most important part was that Yosef passed away. And the last words, Vayosem ba'orin b'Mitzrayim. Yosef is placed in a casket in Mitzrayim. He's buried in Egypt. Why was Yosef buried in Egypt? The deeper reason for that is because Yosef has to be with the Jewish people in Egypt. Because by Yosef being with them, the Jewish people had a link to the transcendental past, to Yaakov and to Yosef, to those who are beyond the exile, those who can master the exile. If Yosef would not be in Egypt, then the Jews wouldn't have that link, then God forbid, they would have been completely swallowed up in Egypt, never to come out again. But it was because Yosef was buried with them, means he remained in them, he was with them. He couldn't be alive. Because as long as Yosef was alive, we said earlier, the holiness was so powerful, the darkness couldn't take hold of them. So the last pasuk of Sefer Bereishis is really setting the stage for the entire Sefer Shemos. Since the whole book of Shemos is that we have to rectify the world through the Torah and the mitzvahs. God gives us Torah and mitzvahs, and through this we apply this to the world and change all the world. And to change it, we have to be within it. And within it means that we have to first be in a state of exile. And from the state of exile, we can change the galus and elevate it. So you need two things. On the one hand, Vayomas Yosef. Yosef dies, which means Yosef can't be there in order to allow for the next stage to happen. But in order for us not to become destroyed in that gullus, Vayosem Ba'orin B'Mitzrayim. Yosef stays and remains with us in Egypt. He doesn't go and be buried in the land of Israel. He remains with the Jewish people in Mitzrayim to empower them and give them that strength that even when they're within, they're really free people. And they're really the kings of Egypt, as was later demonstrated. So that's why what's the last thing Yosef tells them? Yosef is the one who tells them, Pakad Yifkad Elakim, God is going to remember you, you're going to liberate you. Because Yosef is the power of redemption that is holding on to the Jew not to get completely crushed and disintegrate in the darkness of Golus, in the darkness of the exile. So now we understand how the entire theme of Bereishis is emphasized, the main point in the first line and the last verse in Bereshis. The first line tells us, because as we said earlier, the point of Bereshis is God's dominance over the creation. Created a world, and then He controls the world to the very end. And for that reason, we see that in the beginning, Hashem created heaven and earth. However, in order that Bereshis Bara Elokim, that Hashem created heaven and earth, should be felt in every nook and cranny of creation, should be felt in every far corner of the world, you need to take that Sefer Shemos, that Hashem is going to, that the Book of Redemption. In order to implement that, that Bereshis Bara Elokim should be felt everywhere, we have the last verse. Yosef passes away. Vayosem ba'orein bin Mitzrayim. Yosef is placed in Mitzrayim, enabling the Jewish people to implement Bereshis Bara, that God created heaven and earth, even in the land of Egypt, and consequently, all the Goliaths, all the exiles thereafter, bringing the truth of Hashem to the entire world. This is the chazak. This is the tremendous chizik that we get in the end of Bereshis. We get chizik, we get strengthened by the fact and knowing that even if we feel that the darkness has taken such a possession on us, taken hold of us, and it seems to be crushing us, seems to be cutting us off completely from our spiritual self. Sometimes we feel like the Jews of Egypt. We go through so much suffering materially, but especially spiritually, where we almost feel that our neshama has been extinguished, that all spirituality, we're so swamped by physicality, we're so swamped by the material needs of our body. We feel sometimes entrapped by the addictions of the body and so forth, and we can't get out of it. And we cry and we say, Hashem, is all lost. We chas v'shalom can fall into despair. We cry and we feel that we're cemented in Egypt. Or as the verse says later, that Paro is bathing in our blood. Blood of the Jewish people. Blood represents passion. Paro is the Yetzirah. The Yetzirah is bathing in your blood. Meaning he's stealing all your passion into negative things. Into unholiness. It feels like everything is lost. What's the point? So the chizuk we get is that even when it's so dark, and there's a purpose to the darkness, there's a purpose to the concealment, it's in these concealments we have the power to rise above the concealment. It's those moments that we go beyond, that we break out. And yes, a moment that we go beyond our ego, a moment when we care about someone else and we do something for another person, a moment that we daven, and a moment that we study Torah, a moment that we connect to God. In the midst of this crushing darkness, we have, that's the moment of liberation. And we have that because Yosef is with us, and the Gullus will not destroy us. None of us. All of us will remain, we remain intact. We remain with the ability to break free of this exile and to march to the redemption, and we will soon see the ultimate redemption. We will dance with Mashiach forever and ever.
mit dem Kindheit, bald wirst du ausgeleist zusammen mit mir auf der Mut. Ich dich dir zu suchen, dich mehr nicht verjugen, find deine Heimere zu suchen.